Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. This is Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. There's still a lot of summer left at Connecticut's Beardsley Zoo, and there's loads of things to plan for this fall as well. Come along as we head to the zoo to talk with one of their dedicated educational professionals and get a lesson about the beautiful and fascinating monarch butterflies. You'll also find out how you can help preserve and rebuild our fragile population of monarchs while hearing about other pollinator activities and so much more. Then, it's up the road to Meriden to visit with a couple of leaders at the Community Economic Development Fund, CEDF, one of Connecticut's only statewide treasury-certified community development financial institutions. If you're looking to establish your own business, we'll clue you in on how CEDF supports the growth and success of small businesses in Connecticut, especially in underserved communities, through a powerful combination of capital, coaching, and education. Then our next summer rerun takes us back to our live broadcast from Connecticut Ag Day last spring. As we close out this week's conversations, we're going to replay our conversation with Connecticut Commissioner of Agriculture, Brian Hurlburt. In the meantime, let's head for the zoo.
It's always great when we get a chance to get out of the studio and into the field, and today is one of those days as we sit here and look up to the beautiful monarch butterfly that is lighting on one of the native plants here at the Beardsley Zoo, Connecticut's only zoo. We're pleased to be back with a familiar voice on the award-winning For the People, Jen Farrell, taking a leading role today in our program. As we begin to talk about a number of the things that she's involved with as a zoo educator here at the Beardsley Zoo. We've got a lot of activities to talk about, but most importantly, we're going to be focusing on a group of insects that need our help as their human caregivers, and that is our pollinators. And to that end, we've got a couple of events we're going to be keying in on that can engage you and your children and your families, friends, offices, scout troops, social clubs, neighborhoods. We'll take you. We are coming up on Monarch Watch here, a major activity that the zoo is doing, and we'll be telling you all about that right after this reminder.
Following a season of meaningful academic gains and joyful community connection through summer tutoring, the New Haven Tutoring Initiative wants to highlight a very special back-to-school event that's even more special for us here at Connoisseur Media. This August, local leaders and organizations will meet students and families where they are with resources, school supplies, and encouragement at our very special Sam Tillery Back-to-School Rally. It's happening this Thursday, August 14th from 2 to 4 at Bowen Field in New Haven, located next to Hill House High School. A long-standing tradition in New Haven, this rally honors the late Sam Tillery's legacy by bringing families together for community celebration and readiness. We hope you'll come out and join us.
So we're here at the Beardsley Zoo with zoo educator Jen Farrell, who has been kind enough to teach me how to tag a monarch butterfly in a previous segment of For the People. Jen, let's first let folks get to know you a little bit. Tell us a little bit about your background and when you first got engaged in making a decision to make a life's career out of working in this kind of atmosphere here at the Beardsley Zoo.
Wow, it can be quite the winding story. And you know what? I find that most of the case for everyone I work with. All of my colleagues have such a rich history on what they've specialized in, what school they went to, what major they did, and then switched. So we all have a really robust, background in knowledge and expertise. So I'm fortunate to have one of those types of stories. So I actually got my bachelor's of science at Eastern Connecticut State. I wanted to be a therapist. I was, my major was in psychology. I really had a deep, I love connecting with people. I love, getting to know everybody around me and, you know, sharing perspectives. And I really wanted to go down that path. At the time, you know, I was 22. I had just freshly graduated college and didn't have a lot of life experience and felt, you know what, I need to really get into the work sector to kind of feel that out and make sure this is really what my path is meant to be. So fortunately, I had a really wonderful friend of mine. She is a teacher, and she still is all this time later. She's a done sixth grade middle school teacher for over 10 years, and she worked for a place called Nature's Classroom, and that was a place where 6th, 7th, 8th grade students could just come, disconnect them from phones, get them off technology, let them guide them through the trails, teach them wilderness skills, teach them, you know, they are capable on their own two feet and to explore and to ask questions. So I did that for a few years and really, like, gelled with it instantly. I enjoyed being outside. I enjoyed inspiring others and still getting to connect with kids and everyone around me.
So that was the lane you were meant to be in.
It certainly felt that way.
Now to the destination.
To the destination. Now into the destination, that's when I looked at sharpening that skill set a little bit more with wildlife and animals, and that's where I found the zoo. So I started volunteering first because we have a wonderful adult program for anyone who wants to be a docent, anyone who wants to just come and be here. And so I did that for about a year, and that's when I met my boss for the first time, Jim Knox, and he was like, oh, okay, you have a pretty strong teaching background. We have a spot for you. And so I did seasonal work through the CDC, which is another teen program we have here, Conservation Discovery Corps, for high school students. And then in 2018, they hired me as a full-time educator, and in a way, the rest is history.
Was your first zoo experience as a child, as mine was, here at the Beardsley?
Yeah, one of them. So I actually recall my favorite habitat was the prairie dogs. So that had always, it was probably the most interactive at the time because you had the wonderful tunnels that you could go in and pop up like a prairie dog. You could get really close to them with a barrier in place. But also the first pet I had growing up were guinea pigs. So they reminded me of my guinea pigs. And so I had such a connectedness and attachment to them. So I have very fond memories of being a child here.
And the Beardsley Zoo has done an incredible job in keeping up with providing these immersive atmospheres for people of all ages to both enjoy and learn from and maybe walk away with a sense that they want to play a role in preservation and things like that. What are a couple of the most new and exciting things that are happening here at the zoo from a facility standpoint?
Well, from a facility standpoint, especially being an AZA accredited facility, so that stands for Association of Zoos and Aquariums, we always need to be looking at, one, what are our welfare standards for all of the animals under our care? And that includes making sure that the land we are on, we're developing it to the best of our abilities to make sure that those animals have the adequate space they have plenty of place to interact if they're a social species, they have plenty of place to be solitary if they're a solitary species. And then, of course, making sure they have the proper food, the right diet, to, again, the best of our abilities to get those, you know, whether it's produce, grain, meat, any of the above. And making sure that they have enrichment. So because they're here and we only have so much space, we need to mimic the changing of their environments as best as we can, whether that be seasonal or whether that's just through furniture. Like with birds, birds are always perching on a different tree probably every 15 minutes. So we need to make sure that we're adjusting perching, we're adjusting you know, logs, we're doing substrate changes, and making sure that the animals are living the best lives they can.
And from also from a facility standpoint, I know the last time I walked through the zoo, you were teetering on the edge of getting ready to open the Andean bear exhibit.
Yes.
Is that the latest, you know, experiential space that folks visiting the zoo get to see, or has there been an additional room or area put online since then?
I would say the Andean bear, while still recent, probably is one of the biggest, but not the only adjustment and rearrange we've been doing. We actually just refreshed our rainforest building just across the way over there. So we were able to refresh the walls, refresh some of the habitats so people can still enjoy. the rainforest building and all the animals that we have coming in, and also making room for new animals, hopefully down the line. Also the prairie dogs. So again, just as I was fondly talking about, the prairie dogs got a refresh as well. So we're not, you know, stopping at just the Indian bear. We're looking at all of our habitats.
Well, with a nod to your marketing, and certainly to my partners at Dynormis, who are playing an important role, and thanks to them for helping to arrange this interview today, the zoo has done, the Beardsley Zoo has done an incredible job in communicating and engaging without overwhelming, in my opinion, in terms of its outreach. I really, really appreciate knowing about the comings and, sadly, the goings of favorite animals and other residents here at the zoo. It's sad to hear when they leave us permanently and pass away. But certainly, even when they're leaving to go somewhere else, it's an interesting story. But nothing like the celebration of new and incoming residents here at the zoo. And you have a new young panda on the property?
Yes, we do. So we have Pilot, so short for Politis. So he is our newest red panda addition. We're super excited to pair him up with our female Ponya, who still in a way is new in her own right. She's been here just a little bit longer, but still new to the facility. And they are absolutely captivating audiences. I mean, red pandas are such a charismatic animal just looking at them alone. But personality-wise, these are both very young animals and hopeful to carry on their genetics and hopefully having young of their own here someday.
And while one of my favorites is also the prairie dog exhibit, I really love the otters. And you have some, at least a new, relatively new otter on board here?
I think right now we still have the mother-daughter. So we still have Tahu and we still have Flo, I believe. So we still have mother-daughter for right now. A couple of the babies that we had a couple years ago have since gone on to other facilities and other zoos in their own right. But we still have those two, and they still, of course, the otters always put a smile on everyone's faces.
Yeah, excellent. Well, let's talk about some of the smallest residents of the zoo, and almost none of which are caged or housed. And we'll start it off with Monarch Watch, because along with Frog Watch, these are two super public engagement opportunities that really don't cost anybody anything, but anybody who participates is, in some small way, making a global impact.
Yeah, so actually, this coming weekend, I'm heading to Pennsylvania. I'm going to be talking about the Frog Watch chapter at the NEPARC conference. So that's Northeast Partners in Amphibian and Reptile Conservation. And we're sharing our chapter is one of the biggest in the nation right now, and we account for 10% of the national data, which is no small feat. So we want to share that success with others and other facilities on how we can continue to partner up with other you know, stakeholders in the field, and how we can continue to amplify this amazing progress by our chapter volunteers.
So certainly while the hopping frogs are play a critical role in our environmental infrastructure in every neighborhood and wetland in Connecticut, it's the monarch butterfly that has just such an incredibly fascinating story for you to tell.
Absolutely. So Monarch Watch is, I'm biased when I say it, is one of my favorite programs, and I'm so grateful that I got to start it here at Beardsley Zoo. Now, granted, I did not start the program on a national level. That is actually through the University of Kansas's entomology department. They've been running it for well over 10 years, and it is a fantastic program to get people really focused on not just the monarch butterfly, but pollinators as a whole. Because oftentimes, when you're spending time in the field, you notice other species, and maybe you also find enjoyment and learn something new about another type. But the monarch butterfly is probably one of the most iconic butterflies out there. Often when I'm talking to our zoo patrollers or our kids here on grounds, you ask them, you know, name a butterfly, and either they will say monarch or they'll say the orange one. So the one that has those bright orange colors, the black, the white spots, that actually is what we know as aposematic coloration. That is the coloration that's known as warning colors, like you see in poison dart frogs to say, hey, watch out, don't eat me. I probably won't taste very good, and that's actually due to the host plant that they like to eat, that's milkweed, in their larval stage. So it has a special chemical in it that can make them distasteful to other predators, and over the years, birds have learned probably not to engage with this type of butterfly. But because of their bright colors, everyone knows what they are, but many people are often surprised to hear that their numbers have been in decline for quite a while. So what Monarch Watch does is they place tags on the wings of monarch butterflies, particularly those of what's called the migratory generation. So something else that surprised people is monarchs actually go through roughly 4 generations in a year, or at least in a season. So monarchs that have been overwintering down in Mexico start flying on up, and then they lay the groundwork for the next generation. That generation hatches from their eggs. They go through that 4-part metamorphosis, the complete metamorphosis that they undergo. And actually part of their scientific name, Danaus plexippus, just means sleepy transformations. Oh. So that's a fun way to remember that they go through those dynamic changes throughout their lifetime to become a butterfly. So when we're tagging them in the field, we're looking for the generation that's actually being born about right now. And by the end of August, they will have gone through their transformation to become the butterflies that will be flying south for the winter to continue that cycle all over again.
So how can people get involved in Monarch Watch, and what would their responsibilities be?
So a couple options. Of course, you can go to monarchwatch.org's website for the national level and just research on what the program's all about. But here at the zoo, I like to give a more personal approach, especially if you're interested but not sure how you want to engage. So what people can do is go to our website, beardsleyzoo.org. You can look under Education tab, under Get Involved, and you will find Monarch Watch. If you click on that, you'll see the 3 dates that we have for trainings. It's all done online first. And then if you want to come to the zoo, I set up a sign-up list for volunteers to come meet me in person, and we will practice tagging them so that you're confident to either keep coming back to the zoo throughout the season, or you can do it in your own backyard or any other pollinator garden that you have access to.
Great. Not to isolate the monarch butterfly and the pollinator family, the zoo is also dedicating a day to honeybees.
Yeah, that's right. So we're not just celebrating the monarch and butterflies, but all pollinators, and in particular the honeybee. So particularly when it comes to honeybees, they are also a very powerful pollinator. When it comes to a lot of pollinator statistics, we like to tell people 1 out of every 3 bites of food you take in your life is because of a pollinator. And it shows just how much we need them, not just, you know, for other species and other life, but our own in our own agriculture is thanks to honeybees. Mm. So they are a very dynamic critter. They are definitely one that many are afraid of because probably they grew up fearing the sting of that bee. But really, they are meant to work, and they're very hyper-focused on that. So we are setting up tabletops around the zoo. We have our education staff is coming up with content to celebrate the honeybee and teach a little bit about how you can respect, learn about, and support honeybees as well.
I guess if we were to leave anyone with a little radio lesson, it's that to remind them that the honeybees just have the one stinger.
Correct.
And they're predominantly used in clusters to defend the hive. So the honeybee isn't going to be that insect that's going to fly from the flower onto your arm and aggressively sting you once. Because they're not going to waste that that stinger and their life on dispensing it to someone who's just standing around.
Yeah, that one bee that often people see and are often running away from, that's just a scout. And really, they are just doing their job, and that's all they want to do is they want to collect their nectar, they want to collect their pollen, they want to get back to the hive, and they want to help others find where they need to go. So, again, they have jobs, and usually one you do not have to worry about. It's just getting too close to the hive or disrupting the hive.
Very good. Well, there's still a lot of summer left here at the Beardsley Zoo. We're so pleased to be here on site today on this beautiful early August day with Jen Farrell. She is a zoo educator and a good friend of ours on the award-winning For the People. A couple of things happening in the next few weeks before they conclude is this fabulous program Around the World in 30 Minutes, which is literally happening as we're sitting here in an adjacent space to the zoo.
Yes. So, of course, in the summertime, we have shows for the public, and it's included with your ticket. No one has to pay extra for it. We want everyone to come and meet our amazing animal ambassadors. So at the zoo, of course, we have all the animals you can visit with around the grounds, but there's also another cluster of animals that many people don't get to see, and that's the animals from our education department. And they are part of this show. We are highlighting, geographic locations where these animals are naturally from, highlighting the great adaptations that they have to live in the various habitats they're from and why they're important to our environment and why they're important to learn about. So that's the basis of the show. It's, again, roughly 30 minutes, hence the title, and people get to really see these animals up close and all their amazing natural behaviors.
And while that's kind of a homegrown show, you also have the asset of bringing in hired experts, including our friends from Sky Hunters.
Absolutely. So on the end weekends of the shows, we have Sky Hunters in Flight, so Master Falconers Brian and Teddy Bradley. They bring all of their birds of prey, so anywhere from owls to hawks to falcons, and they showcase just how an apex predator is. That we have the daytime shift predators and the nighttime shift predators, and they really do a fantastic job flying their birds over the heads of our audience, captivating and wowing audience with how different the flight patterns are, how quick some birds are, and just how amazing their adaptations are when it comes to hunting and how laser targeted they are.
Turning toward fall, I have to say I was honored and privileged to be one of the first people to ever see the Glow Wild Lantern Festival here at the zoo several years ago. And everyone, bar none, that I've either recommended to them to visit or anyone who I've heard of who has just organically come out to it, have uniformly been thrilled. It's a breathtaking display, and also showcases a little something different, and that is sort of the zoo as a facility for public art.
Yes. So we are so grateful to have the Glow Lantern Festival again. Our public year after year has really been enjoying it. So to bring it back and also to change it up each time. So we always make sure all the lanterns are animal themed around grounds. And it really takes our areas like the gardens and the areas in between habitats, and it fills out that space. And it's a lovely evening walk. There's cider, there's donuts. It's very fall cozy. And people can also learn about the lanterns and how they relate to some of the animals and wildlife we have here. So it's a fantastic event.
So anyone who's listening, you can be among the first to pollinate your excitement over the Glow Wild event to your friends and social network pals and followers, because tickets go on sale and this event begins in just a few days on the 18th of August.
Yes. So it'll keep running, I believe, until
December 14th.
Yeah,
yes.
So mid-December. So it will be on for quite a while. And again, you can always go on our website, beardsleyzoo.org, and you will find tickets right there.
Yeah, so I guess the advantage is if you're an early bird and you come to the first month or so of Glow Wild, it'll be getting darker later, but once we get into the thick of the fall and early winter and it gets dark earlier, that's when virtually all the visitors are going to get the full darkness contrast of these gorgeous and sometimes massive displays.
Yes, but I will say, even in the light of day, these sculptures are spectacular. They're in such detail. The benefit, too, even if it's not as dark, some of them do move. So yes. Some are animatronic. The wings will flap. The heads will move. So either way, whether it's by dusk or under the cloak of darkness, it's absolutely beautiful and breathtaking.
Very good. So the other exciting thing that I learned of before we turned on the microphone this morning was how programs that were started as pilots or limited sometimes really, really take hold. And your Zootots program now is celebrating a year-round curriculum.
Correct. So in the fall and the spring, for many years, we had our Zootots program. It's gauged for learners 22 months all the way to 4 years of age. And it's a half-hour program, so very quick. Parents, grandparents are welcome to come join. And we have story time, we have crafts, we get to meet a special animal ambassador. And they're typically tied around a very specific theme we would like the students to learn. Fall, of course, being a wonderful time of year, we're focusing on harvest, so animals that are looking to hibernate and collect food. We're looking at, for Halloween, we have what's called Not So Scary, so learning about animals that maybe we think are scary but actually are quite endearing and cute and very charismatic. So we take the time to have the Zootots come at least once a month. You can find all of that on our website as well under education. And we are so fortunate now that so many people enjoy it so much that we can do it year-round.
And also the all-important mission of continuing to promote literacy and getting kids to read. You have Fairy Tale Days.
Yes, we do have Fairy Tale Days. So that is in September, I believe. So when that happens, not only are we focused on all of the fairy tales and stories, but you're going to probably see the characters live in person and in costume. So kids can come meet their favorite Disney character or superhero character, and they can get to spend a wonderful day at the zoo. Oh, there it is, September 13th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m.
Excellent. Very good. In closing, Jen, membership is a critical driver, but provides a wealth of benefits to folks. And while the Beardsley Zoo gets the bulk of the benefit of membership in terms of dollars, it also helps the zoo in its standing on the national and global stage.
Yeah, absolutely. So membership is definitely key. Not the only pillar, but so important to making sure we can do what we do by not just supporting the animals that are here, but supporting our members who are coming through our gates every single day. So making sure that we're doing right by them, by when they come to see us, they can be learning something new, they can have an experience with their friends and family they won't forget, and they can take what they've learned in their knowledge and hopefully bring it out into the bigger world.
And for folks who might be looking for a ultimately interesting place to hold some sort of a gathering, whether it's a corporate event or some sort of a family reunion or party, the zoo is a perfect environment for that virtually year-round.
Yeah, and actually the zoo has won many awards for our venue as well, especially when it comes to weddings. So our events director, Lindsay Durkee, does a fabulous job hosting and helping events. So whether you're having a get-together in the south end of our greenhouse amongst all thousands of exotic plants around you, we have our carousel building, which has the Pleasure Beach carousel right over there, and even, old relics from other carousel horses, to even, just the grounds alone. So if you're looking for a corporate event, a wedding, just a place to spend time with friends and family, we have a wonderful events department.
And I would be remiss in not saying the Beardsley Zoo makes a fantastic entry portal to a ton of fantastic tourism experiences throughout New Haven, Fairfield County, and Western Connecticut. So you can make your first stop in a day-long or a staycation or a weekend or a week-long trip maybe across the Sound from Long Island or from wherever you may be listening to the program on our podcast somewhere around the world. We'd love to see you here in Fairfield County and New Haven County and at the Beardsley Zoo. Let's wrap it up just letting folks know again about the website and where they can go to get their adventure started.
Yeah, so you can get your adventure started looking at our website at beardsleyzoo.org.
Jen Farrell, Fantastic work as the diplomat of the Zoo Educator Corps here and your entire team at the Beardsley Zoo here in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Connecticut's only zoo. We'd love to have you, and we hope you'll consider joining us, whether it's to participate in Monarch Watch, to come and learn more about our other pollinators on Honeybee Day, or to take in a number of the remaining summer, or engage and get your tickets or participate in a number of the fall or year-round activities. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we're continuing our road trip here, and as I said, from Beardsley Zoo and another episode that we recorded recently, it's great to get out of the studio and off the phone and face-to-face with guests, and especially when I am their guest, and today I'm the guest of the Community Economic Development Fund, or CEDF. They're a mission-driven, nonprofit Connecticut economic development organization that's providing business loans in disadvantaged communities. And in other Connecticut municipalities, CEDF lends to business borrowers with household incomes below state median. A lot more information about the organization coming our way from my two guests here this morning, their president and CEO, Jim Bezdira, and Fred Welk, who is the director of business development. We'll be back with those guys right after a few words about one of our local nonprofits.
Bridgeport's own Housatonic Museum of Art is proud to present Ink and Impressions, 110 years of the Society of American Graphic Artists, SAGA, a landmark national exhibition celebrating the legacy and innovation of American printmaking. Featuring 160 hand-pulled prints by artists from across more than 30 states, this anniversary showcase honors SAGA's 110-year history and 90 years of annual exhibitions. You're invited to a free and festive opening reception with participating artists and appetizers happening on September 10th, commemorating the diversity and daring nature of contemporary and historical printmakers. For more information on this and other Housatonic Museum of Art activities, just visit housatonicmuseum.org.
So here we are in Meriden, right off the big Cloverleaf interchange here. You guys are smack dab in the middle of all the action here, right where the big new reconstruction project is happening. So if you hear a little bit of noise in the background or fire sirens, it's because we're also right next to a fire station. So no worries there. So Jim, thank you so much for having us here this morning. Lots to talk about, and especially these days. You know, as I talk to folks in commercial real estate and in business development, you know, interest rates have got people going crazy. Some of the unknowns or the quick shifting sands coming out of the nation's capital also have thrown a lot of people in the business community for a loop. But you guys have been rock solid for decades.
Well, thank you, John, for having Fred and myself and allowing us a few minutes on your program to share with you and your listeners about, I think, the very good work that CEDF does every day. So yeah, we were formed in 1994. We're in our 31st year now, so we have a lot of experience. As you said in your introduction, we are a mission-driven small business lender. So we're based here in Meriden, but we operate across all 169 municipalities in our great state. Our focus each and every day, our passion, our resources, are helping out low to moderate income entrepreneurs and small business owners, predominantly in low to moderate income communities and neighborhoods across Connecticut. We're working routinely with true startup businesses, businesses that may be a couple of years old, and seasoned businesses that need capital to either get started, buy a piece of equipment, or grow. And for whatever reason, they're not able to obtain that financing from their local traditional bank. That's the niche we fill. As I said, we've been doing that for 31 years now. So right here in our organization, we can lend from literally as low as a couple of $1,000s up to $500,000, depending on the needs of that individual business. And we really try to meet that entrepreneur, that small business owner, where they are, and provide them the capital and ancillary support to make that business, again, either get started or grow and hire local people from their neighborhoods and really help the state of Connecticut's economy grow as well.
Part of the reason why we like to visit with organizations like yours is because you're somewhat unique in the state of Connecticut, just one of a handful of organizations. You're a nonprofit organization. Could you explain to folks that are listening how being a nonprofit also sets this organization apart from other types of entities that might be engaged in things like business loans?
Sure. So, excellent point. So, yeah, we are a nonprofit. We ourselves are a small business. So we understand what it's like to manage the challenges and have the triumphs and shortcomings of running running a business like ourselves. So because we are mission-driven, nonprofit, we don't have nearly the amount of regulation and compliance issues that banks or other organizations have. We really believe in forming long-term partnerships and relationships with our loan applicants and our eventual borrowers, and being able to be there in the long run to support them, whatever needs they may have.
In your time leading with and being part of CEDF, how have you seen the faces and the demographics of the communities that you serve change here in Connecticut?
Again, great question. I've had the privilege now of being the president here for just a little over 10 years. A lot of things have stayed the same, right? There's still a huge need for startup capital and existing loans from us to get those businesses up and running and growing. But what we have seen in the last, call it 8 to 10 years, is a growing number in Connecticut of minority entrepreneurs getting their businesses formed and growing. So we have grown a lot with African Americans, Blacks, Hispanics, women, and veteran-owned businesses in Connecticut, and that momentum just keeps growing.
And looking forward, do you see this organization reaching sort of like a saturation point given the need, or do you essentially kind of like a barometer, you just you grow and accommodate as the need and the populations correspond?
It would actually be the latter. So we each year, we're probably originating between 50 and 75 new loans, bringing in a lot of new customers each year. That's been the norm now for a couple of decades. There's just a continuing need in Connecticut for the products and services we provide, especially the startup businesses, where the banks in this state do a great job. But, you know, as we all know, banks have a lot of regulations and a lot of compliance they have to live with. We don't have those kind of restrictions, so we can be much more creative, much more flexible than a bank or a credit union can be. So we just really see that ongoing need for new business formation, job growth, and we do not see that slowing down.
CEDF does so much more than just, drive pickups full of cash up to new businesses that are aspiring to grow here in Connecticut. One of the things that I admire about CEDF is the way that you help businesses help themselves with workshops, webinars, trainings, and other details. We'll give you a break for a few minutes, Jim, and meet Fred Welk, Jr., who is, as I said in the introduction, the Director of Business Development here at the Community Economic Development Fund. Fred, thanks for joining us today. Let's just hear a little bit about yourself and how you came to the organization and have moved into this position where you're providing all this great additional support to help ensure the success of your borrowers.
It seems like the best job I could have ever imagined. I had 23 years as a business owner, actually, in the beauty business and in franchise development. But many changes in the retail marketplace over the years, especially with, the decline of regional shopping malls where we were located, and with the rise of the internet. And, well, the time came when I needed something different. And, in fact, CEDF was a wonderful opportunity. So for 12 years, I've been involved here as a business advisor. The last 8 years or so, handling our business education programming. And as we attempt to grow more, doing a little more in business development lately.
So looking at your own career and how you got started and now kind of positioning that against the work that you're doing here at CEDF, do you see the extreme value of all these added value services and support that perhaps you had had to learn yourself, the old school hard knocks situation?
Absolutely, and you're right. It is a school of hard knocks out there if you don't have anyone to mentor you or look over your shoulder. In some of our access to capital presentations that I do, I point out the fact that no one ever taught me how to go and approach a lender to get a business loan, whether it's a community lender like us or a bank. And there's things that you got to think about in order to be successful in business. But we're very proud of our business advisory program that supplies those inputs for our borrowers.
Man, this isn't just send them a link and it's a one-size-fits-all approach. You guys are very dedicated to individualized coaching.
Well, it's a very important part of our program in order to, help business owners be sustainable. We try to be out with our borrowers, as often as they need, maybe typically once a month or so in order to really understand their concerns and what the business needs. But our business advisors, I'm pleased to say, all have a background of business ownership. And we think that makes a terrific difference when you yourself have paced the floor and worried about making payroll on Friday. You're more empathetic. We coach across a whole range of industries because their fundamentals are pretty much the same, and we can provide those inputs in management, marketing, finance, but also importantly the emotional component of business ownership, because being willing to get up every morning and put your foot in front of the other in order to face the wars of small businesses is sometimes difficult. And even long past COVID, we have to dry a few tears once in a while and help people pep themselves up.
Yeah, or move on to the next chapter. I imagine that's also got to be a very challenging thing for both the businesses and the coaches, especially when it's going to involve having to recapitalize.
Well, there are times when things get a little more difficult, and sometimes you do have to face up to doing something different in a different way. And I think many of our business owners, have either personally had experiences that have informed things like that, or they've helped enough clients throughout our last 5 years here of COVID and the post-COVID era, where we understand what it's required to help people make those transitions, although it's not terribly frequent, I'll say.
Yeah. Well, along with the one-on-one approach to coaching the businesses that come to the Connecticut Economic Development Fund, you do complement that with a platform called WeTeachSuccess.org. What's that all about?
Well, back in the deep in the COVID era, 2020, we realized that the architecture of our existing CEDF.com website did not show off some of the features and the programs and the information that we had to offer very well. So we put up a dedicated website, and this allows us to kind of showcase the replays of the webinars, the podcast series that we've produced, the published articles we have, and the free courses that we offer. And so it's a good way to show the panorama of the material that's available to help small businesses. And we get quite a bit of traction with that, and it's very useful for our borrowers and also for the business community at large, because a lot of small business owners who are new to a particular subject or sometimes those that are aspiring to be business owners, make use of that material.
So as we play this segment here on the 10th of August, you've got workshops coming up online starting in just a few days.
Yeah, we've got next week we're doing something on B2B business development with LinkedIn. And then later in the month of August, we have kind of a hands-on workshop, two-part series on a program called Canva that small businesses can use to make graphic layouts and things to help kind of accelerate their marketing, especially when they're on a tight budget. And then in early September, we're doing our Take a Smart Approach to Launching Your Business program at the Ferguson Library in Stanford, and that's going to be in Spanish. In fact, about half of our programming nowadays is in Spanish, and that's a growing community, of course, here in Connecticut that we're trying to serve.
Now, does access to the WeTeachSuccess.org platform require already being a customer, so to speak, of CEDF, or is this something that is available to anyone who's interested in learning more?
No, it's available to everyone here in Connecticut, and it's free. There is a registration on the site, but it's very quick and simple. Nonprofit organization kind of has to, count noses, so to speak, and keep track of who they are serving. And so we have a few simple questions that we ask in order to make reports to our grant funders and such.
Thanks, Fred. Let's get back to Jim Bzdura, the CEO and president here at CEDF. We mentioned the capitalization word. Let's talk a little bit more about some of what makes CEDF different when it comes to loan capital, Jim.
Sure. So again, there's a phrase out there called patient debt, and we are one of those lenders. So, we're providing loan capital, loans to small businesses. But like a lot of small businesses, there's always challenges and hiccups along the way. So if a business truly, finds itself up against a big, big challenge, and they need maybe 3 months or 4 months of either paying us interest only or deferring their payment totally, we're there to support that. We are, again, no disrespect to banks, they all do a great job, but given the fact that we are mission-driven, we're patient, our goal is to do our very, very best to keep that business in existence, up and operating, keep those local jobs that the business owners have hired in place. So if that business needs a short break from their payments to us, as long as they're very communicative and upfront and they're working very closely with our business advisory, that's something we entertain on a relatively regular basis. Whatever we can do, John, to support those businesses and get them through the rough times, we're here to do that for them.
Yeah. There's, kind of the old cliche is, I came to the city with $50 in my pocket, and here I am today, a millionaire entrepreneur. It all starts sometimes with just a few bucks, and microloans are something that CEDF does expertly. Why don't we define what microloans are to folks that are listening and let them know how they might be able to avail themselves to just that little bit of a jump start that might, kind of light the fuse to something really incredible.
Sure. So the SBA, the Small Business Administration, has a microloan program. We've been involved with that now for about 25 years. And I'm proud to say, John, that we've been the number one SBA microlender in Connecticut for 12 years in a row. It's a product that we take very seriously. And again, those loans range from a low of $1,000 up to a maximum of $50,000, all term loans, very fairly priced. So for whether you're a startup, a young or existing business, and you need $1,000 or $2,000 to buy a couple of laptops, as an example, or you need up to $50,000 to buy a meaningful piece of equipment for your business, where you may have a need for some permanent working capital, the SBA microloan program really is a great product that fits that niche very, very well.
Great. Fred, when it comes to the successes of the folks who come to CEDF, the happy endings are many, way too many to talk about more than just one or two of them today. But I know there's a couple that come to mind when you think of the full trajectory of a business story after they walk through the door here.
Well, I've got a couple in mind right now because I've either helped them or dealt with them lately, and one would be an APRN who has a very interesting story with her integrated medicine practice because she had a difficult time with a diagnosis herself, and that I guess helped her focus on how she wanted to handle her patients. And another being a coffee roaster that has done phenomenally in getting into the wholesale market with a very high-quality product, thanks to us getting them a bigger roasting machine to expand their production.
Fantastic. So I guess the last thing to leave everybody with is how to get in touch with CEDF to find out if they're the right fit and you're the right fit, and we're off on the road to success.
Well, a lot of information available there to help school those who are trying to consider whether debt capital, a business loan is right for them. That's CEDF.com. And our educational website is WeTeachSuccess.org. The websites are linked together, so it's very easy to move between them as needs change or develop or people want to explore.
The Community Economic Development Fund is one of Connecticut's only statewide Treasury-certified community development financial institutions. Founded in 1994, been doing it for over 30 years. We hope that you'll take advantage of their services and all of their education and training. If you are a budding entrepreneur thinking about opening your own business or perhaps taking your business to the next level, we want to thank Fred Welk, who is the Director of Business Development, and Jim Bezdira, who is the President and CEO, for hosting us here at their offices in Meriden. Thank you guys.
The following is an encore presentation of a segment of the award-winning For the People that was recorded and aired previously. Before we replay our interview with Connecticut's Commissioner of Agriculture, Brian Hurlburt, that we recorded back on Connecticut Agriculture Day last spring, we want to remind you about an open invitation to head up to Litchfield County as Palabolas Day returns to Shepug Valley High School in Washington, Connecticut, Saturday, September 27th. This year's all-ages event will include an interactive dance performance of Flight School, three movements workshops, plus sweet treats and lawn games. This is a unique chance for community members across Connecticut to experience the world-renowned dance theater company Palabolas for only $15 for adults and free for all kids under 18. Proceeds from Palabolas Day support bringing Palabolas' movement education programs to Connecticut schools, including performances, in-school workshops, and residencies. To purchase tickets or get more information, visit palabolas.org. That's PILOBOLUS.org.
All right, the calm before the storm here at the state capitol and Connecticut Ag Day 2025, and as we try to do every time we visit here, catch up with our commissioner of the Connecticut State Department of Agriculture, and Brian Hurlburt has been kind enough to give us a few minutes. So, Commissioner, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for being here and celebrating Ag Day with us.
So, let's talk cheese. Connecticut cheese is on the global map now.
Right, right. So we are very proud that Arethusa Cheese Company in northwest corner of Connecticut won back-to-back national awards for best cheese in America. My friends in Wisconsin and Vermont are not very happy, but we're really proud, and they do a great job. And not only do they do a great job making the cheese, but they buy their milk to make the cheese from three small Connecticut farms who otherwise might not have a market. So it's a really important business for the ag economy that's doing amazing things.
And it speaks to the boutique nature of what agriculture right. is becoming and has been for at least a good decade and a half here in Connecticut.
Right. Well, and it used to be buy local, but now it's like buy hyper local, right? We want to know exactly where the food is coming from, who the farmers are. And we can do that in Connecticut because we are such a close-knit community.
The other thing that puts Connecticut on the map is our oysters. Yeah. And we always like to talk about aquaculture because they don't get the equal love, it seems, sometimes. So let's take a few minutes on that.
Yeah, my good friend Commissioner Katie Dykes thinks of Long Island Sound as recreational swimming and fishing. And I think of it as a big farm, right? We've got 60,000 plus acres of shellfish beds in
actually,
Long Island Sound.
The biggest agricultural pursuit in Connecticut is underwater.
That's right, the largest farm in New England is underwater in Long Island Sound and is a Connecticut farmer. So that's a, you know, that's a piece of our past and our future. That's really a tremendous opportunity that people tend to forget, but we don't. And that's why we've been working with our partners at DECD to do the Oyster Trail, to do the Oyster Documentary, to drive people to remember and recognize that resource and those businesses that we have and the tremendous product they put out.
Every time your department sends me their regular e-newsletter, it's packed with maybe not one, not two, or maybe three possible grant or funding opportunities designed to attract, install, and sustain Connecticut farmers. How's it going bringing this young generation of farmers online that are going to be populating the halls here at Ag Day today?
Yeah, so we have spent over the past few years a lot of attention with our new and beginning farmers. We created a new and beginning farmer micro grant program, $5,000 award. We just awarded 12 of those in the last round. We also are looking at second career opportunities. And we know, and you were just acknowledged today for your work with Connecticut Farmer Veterans Coalition, we know that the men and women coming out of the service have a tremendous skill set. And they don't necessarily need to work for somebody else. A lot of them can do very well working for themselves. And at our most recent Ag Transition Grant Award, we were able to award 8 farmer veterans awards to support their business and give them the opportunity. I say it a lot, but we want to look back on our Connecticut agricultural heritage and think about ways that we can sustain that for as far as we can into the future. And the investments that we're making propel those farm businesses to do the next thing, to meet the customer where they are, and to be ready for it.
We're blessed that these veterans still continue to want to serve their neighbors and their state with a work ethic that is maybe unmatched.
Oh, nobody works harder. I mean, nobody works harder than a farmer. Nobody works harder than a farmer veteran because they know how to get the job done. And the service teaches them to do what they can with the resources they have available. So they are problem solvers. They're figuring out how to get something done with what they have on hand, which is a great skill set to apply in farming.
Well, we've hit 3 very positive points. I hate to steer us toward how you and your department is dealing with the avian flu situation here in Connecticut, but is there a silver lining or at least a light at the end of the tunnel as far as you can see today?
Well, we're working closely with our partner agencies of the Department of Public Health and the Department of Consumer Protection on avian influenza, both in dairy and in poultry. We're very concerned about this. And I think the silver lining is that people acknowledge that we have farms in our community, that they are farm businesses, that animal health and human health are closely related, and so we've got to make sure that we're protecting our farms to protect our neighbors. And Connecticut farmers are stepping up. We're distributing PPE across the state through the Department of Public Health to make sure that farmers have masks and gloves and booties so that they're reducing the risk. We're working with our partners at UConn Extension to put on webinars and forums so that people know how they can protect their farm. Because protecting their farm is not only about protecting their farm, it's about protecting their neighbors and the farms around them. And that's the message we're trying to drive home on that.
Very good. Thank you so much. CT.gov/DOAG is the website that anybody needs to go to learn more about the many things the Connecticut Department of Agriculture is doing here today and into the future. I'm pleased to have Commissioner Brian Hurlburt back on as we open up our special report from Ag Day at the Capitol 2025. Commissioner, thank you again.
Thank you so much.
Listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a PSA for our program that's relevant to the audiences and communities we serve, you must make your request for consideration in writing via email to john.vocat@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program can be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station websites. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs John Vokette. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime. Just find it under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.